We're going to continue tonight with our study in Daniel, and we can begin to move along there. And whether we get through the first chapter or not tonight, we'll make some progress, we trust. Daniel chapter 1. Now, we have been in the first part of this chapter, of course, saw that Nebuchadnezzar brought certain of the children of Israel, along with some vessels of the house of God, to Babylon. And this was in the first of three deportations from Jerusalem to Babylon. And in this first group came these four young men that are mentioned in verse 6, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the first thing they did when they got there was to change their names. The prince of the eunuchs gave them names, verse 7, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar. And Daniel means in the Hebrew, God is my judge, or God is judge. And Belteshazzar means Bel's prince, one of the gods of Babylon. And so you can see what they were trying to do. They wanted to give them Chaldean names so that they would begin to think of themselves as Chaldeans, as Babylonians, instead of Jews. They wanted to get that identity change of the name. Names mean so much, and especially to a Hebrew, this would be true. His name was given to him at birth, and it all most generally spoke of some relationship to his God. And so the heathen had names that were also tied to their gods. Now that their gods had captured these young men, that meant that their gods were stronger than the gods of the Hebrews. And so they've changed their name, and that was a humiliating thing as well. Hananiah, which means Jehovah is gracious, was changed to Shadrach, which means some give it illumined by the sun god. The sun god was Aku, A-K-U. So under the command of Aku, that's what Shadrach meant. So that tied it to the sun god that they worshipped. And then Mishael was changed to Meshach. Mishael in Hebrew is who is as God. That's what the word means. Who is as God? In other words, there's none like our God. And so his name is changed to Meshach, which is who is like Venus, or who is what Arku is, as some interpret that. But in either case, instead of who is like the God of the Hebrew, it's who is like the God of the Babylonian. See how this would, hopefully, they thought maybe help in making these into Babylonian citizens. Azariah is Jehovah has helped, or the Lord is my help. Jehovah, the Lord, is my help. And Abednego means the servant of Nego, one of the gods, again, of the Babylonians. They had many gods, of course. And so Azariah was changed to Abednego, which means the servant of Nego. And so you can see the attempt here is being made to turn these young men, these particular four young men about who we are interested in the book of Daniel. Now, there were many others that were taken. God does not tell us anything about them. There may have been some others who were faithful. As far as we know, these are the only ones who stood faithful. There may have been some others, though, that we don't read about. This story is interested in these four, and particularly in Daniel, although the others play a very important role in chapter 3. After that, we don't hear any more about them, just Daniel. So this prince of the eunuch gave them these names, changed their names, officially changing their names to where they are now to be called by these names, so that when they're asked for, when they have to go before the king, or when they're talked to, There will be no mention of their God in their name. There'll be always some mention of a Babylonian God when they're called, when they're asked to come forth, and so forth. Now, but look at verse 8, and this is one of those outstanding verses of the Bible. I don't know of many verses in the Bible that has so much impact, especially when you're dealing with young people, when you're talking with young people and dealing with young people. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Now, Daniel purposed in his heart. He just said, in effect, I am not going to defile myself. Now, this may lead to death. This may lead to prison, dungeon, whatever it may lead to. But Daniel said, it makes no difference to me. I'm not going to defile myself. Now, he's very nice about it. And he gets it handled in a good way. He doesn't have to go to jail, doesn't have to go to prison, and he doesn't have to violate his conscience. God provides a way for him and the others to not defile themselves. But notice it all began with one 17-year-old boy saying, now get this, one 17-year-old boy, how we got some boys near about that age? One 17-year-old boy saying, I will not defile myself by eating the king's meat or drinking the king's wine. Now, there were several reasons that had to do with that. First of all, the Babylonians ate whatever kind of meat that they wanted to eat. Whereas the Jews, there were only certain meats that they could eat according to the Jewish law. And so, you know, did you ever eat meat you didn't know what it was? Did you ever get in a place and somebody served you some meat and you wondered what it was? You take a bite of it and say, well, it tastes like, no, I don't know whether it's that or not. Take another bite and say, it tastes like pork. I believe it's pork. And you say, no, I believe it's beef, you know. And sometimes it's so doctored up or whatever till you really can't tell what it is. We were on the coast of Greece, down on the Aegean Sea in 1970 or 71, and we ate dinner. We had dinner at this hotel, and they brought us out our meal and put our dish before us and everything, you know, and I'm trying to cut this meat and wondering what it is that they've served me. And then in the process of trying to cut it, it rolled over, and I saw the suction cups on the bottom of it. You know what it was? Octopus. You see those old long tentacles, and they got suction cups all down it. Well, I'd finished that. I ate the rest of what I could eat, but I just couldn't cut that octopus. I just wasn't able to. A gator might have eaten some of that. I don't know. We were down in one of those villages one night, and the fellow was cooking some on the street out there in the Aegean Sea area. And we saw him cooking it and people coming up buying it and eating it, stuff like that. But the Hebrew was forbidden of eating, of course, certain things, including pork and other things that he was not supposed to eat. And so the meat being brought from the king's table, it would be almost impossible to avoid eating something that violated the law. Besides that, the king and the others would know that they were eating these things in violation to their own law. So they'd have no testimony. That would throw their testimony out the window of being good Hebrews, being good Jews who followed Jehovah. So that was one reason. And then, of course, the other reason was that all the food and drink that the king ate was first offered to their gods. It was offered to the gods, then brought in, prepared, and taken to the king to eat, but always first offered to the gods of Babylon. Well, by them accepting this food, they would be saying, we are accepting the gods of Babylon. And so for these reasons, Daniel saw right away, you see, they're preparing these young men to be officers of the court. They're preparing these young men to have a taste for delicacies and a love for good food and fine wine and all those things that the high-ups, the rich, the wealthy, the king's court dined upon. And they want these young men, they're going to get to go up there and sit before that king, and they're going to be answering to him. And so they wanted them to have the very best, you see, so that they'd be properly developed in mind and in body by this good food that they would eat. And so Daniel had to make a decision. He was at a point and a place where he had to make a decision. Now, this is the thing that is so amazing about this thing, is the moral supremacy of these four young men. How these four young men rose above the temptations and did what was right. And of course, they were led by Daniel. Always has to be somebody who leads. And Daniel was the one who said, fellas, I'm not going to eat of it. Now, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm not going to eat of it. And so the rest of them said, we're not either, Daniel. We're with you. Now, they may have stood by themselves anyhow, but they didn't have to. Daniel led the way. It's always good to have somebody leading the way, you know, and taking the right stand. You know, that's so true about young people. Young people, there are a lot of young people who would do what is right if the people they are with will do what is right. If they're with people that are doing right, then they will do right and they'll enjoy it. They won't be upset by doing what is right. But if they are with some people who are not strong that way, and they got some young person amongst them who is a rebel, and he's going to show himself and he's going to push himself into the place of leadership, and he says, I'm not going to do what's right. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this in violation of what I know is right, what my family has taught me, what my church has taught me, what my school has taught me. I'm going to do what I want to do. Then those same young people that would have stood with a fellow who said, I'm going to do right, follow along with a fellow who says, I'm not going to do what's right. They just go along with them. You know. They don't have the character to buck them and to stand and say, no, well, I'm sorry. You may go that way if you choose to, but I'm not going to go that way. I'm going to do what's right. But Daniel, of course, is in a place under great pressure. You know, this pressure. I want to just mention some points of pressure that are pressure to conform here. And some of these we've already talked about, but we'll rehash them. First of all, they were a conquered and humiliated people. See? The great nation of Israel is no longer. The great kings who have controlled so much of that empire and that part of the world are gone. And God is through with the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. He's finished with them. They've sinned to the point that God is finished with them. And so they are conquered, they are humiliated, and yet in spite of that, Daniel purposed in his heart. Then they had been removed from everything that gave them stability and security. They were Jews. They lived and grew up in Jerusalem. They grew up in the time of Josiah, a good king, a godly king, when when things were moving toward God and all the false idols were being destroyed and temples and so forth. And they had been in that kind of a surrounding. And now then, abruptly, now don't forget the age of these. Daniel, some say he's a little younger than 17, but most of the ones that I read concerning this, figure computing his age and so forth, come up with 17. He was 17 years old. He wouldn't even be legally an adult in America today. See, 17 years old, and he's got this kind of character. Don't tell me that you can't build character into young folks that'll stand and stand early. Now, I'm interested in, and I'm going to do some more study, Lord willing, through the Scripture, at what age young people can become spiritual. I think the Bible is very clear about that. Children can't or don't show spirituality. Children show obedience to their parents. That's what children are supposed to do, and that's as spiritual as they can become, is if they're obedient to their parents. But there comes a time in a young person's life when they're in the right environment, under the Word of God, when God begins to speak to them. See, when God begins to deal with their hearts. And see, a lot of times we as parents get all upset with kids. You know, we get upset with kids, and I'm not talking about just little kids. I'm talking about 13s and 14s and 15s and so forth like that. And we get all upset and disturbed at it. Well, they're supposed to obey you. You've got to be the boss over them. You've got to be the head of them. You've got to ride herd on them. You've got to put the spurs in them. God's not going to. He gave them to you. That's what upsets me so, is nobody pays any attention to what I'm saying about this thing. And it could look like they could care less. But God is not going to do for you what He's told you to do. And when God gives you children, you're supposed to ride herd on them and sit on their back and stick the spurs in them and say, bless God, you're going to do it this way. Why? Don't ask me why I said it. That's good enough. That's all they need to know. Because later on they're going to need to know that whenever they obey in God. God doesn't go around talking and explaining things over and over. He just tells you and that's it. You better learn how to obey it when He tells you. And you better learn to obey your mom and your dad that way. You see? But there's a time in young people's lives when God begins to work. And then parents, you need to start getting out of the way. You need to start backing off and let God work. See, Samuel had that experience there at Eli's house at the temple. Old Samuel, you know, he was 3 years old when Mama had to leave him there. And he grew up there in that place obeying Eli. Eli was his spiritual father and his earthly father as far as things of this life are concerned. And Mama saw him once a year when she brought him his little coat she'd made for him and wondered she couldn't hem it till she got there because she didn't know how much he'd grown. And yet she, you know, couldn't wait to get there to get that little coat fixed up for him. And then all of a sudden he grew up and grew up and grew up. And then one night God began to say to him, Samuel? Samuel? Well, he thought it was Eli, but it wasn't Eli. It was God. And God began to speak to him. Oh, the greatest time in the world, parents, is when God begins to speak to your children. When God begins to speak to your children, and you can start backing off, see? Start backing off and letting God do the work and deal with them and do what He wants to do with them. But it doesn't happen, see, till they get up to somewhere, you know, I don't know what. Something may happen, one at 15, another 16, another 17. But Daniel, we know here, and I can go back through the Scriptures and give you several different cases. For instance, Josiah, he became king when he was 8 years old, but it says very clearly when he was 16, God began to deal with him. He didn't deal with him when he was 8, didn't deal with him when he was 9, didn't deal with him when he was 10, didn't deal with him when he was 11, didn't deal with him when he was 12, didn't deal with him when he was 13, didn't deal with him when he was 14, didn't deal with him when he was 15. But he dealt with it when he was 16. Now, God doesn't tell you those things just to let them fall out of and forget them. That's the way God works. See, that's the way God works. And so it's very important. Daniel now is a 17-year-old, and he has had his own relationship with God established, and he is obeying God himself. He doesn't need mama there. Say, go ahead, boy, do what's right. Doesn't need that anymore. He's had to have it back yonder. He doesn't need the priest there saying, Daniel, now when you get off from some time and you're in a tough situation, remember, stay true to God. Stay true to God. Doesn't need the priest anymore. Doesn't need daddy around saying, all right, now, Daniel, I'm going to wear you out if you don't do what you ought to do and like you ought to do. If you're going out behind the barn, have a little lesson out there behind the barn. No, he doesn't need that anymore. He's probably had that when he's growing up. Daniel, just as ornery as any other boy. I can guarantee you that growing up, he wasn't sanctified when he was a kid. He was just a kid. You see, all kids are kids, and all of them are ornery, and all of them are cantankerous, and all of them are that way. That's just the way they are. Don't get upset with that. Don't get disturbed about that. You just do what you ought to do as a mother and father and keep praying for them. The grace of God will do miracles along with a little maturity that you never could accomplish. And all of a sudden it'll happen as God begins to lock in on them and they begin to obey him. And so Daniel's now in that position. And this is the first time, maybe and very likely, that Daniel's ever been in the kind of position. I know it's the first time in a position like this. It may be the first time he's ever had to take any kind of a stand. Here he is in a heathen country. And he's away from family. He's away from his friends. He's away from his home. He's away from the temple. Everything that brought him stability and security, he's got to stand in that kind of a situation. Then he's taken hundreds of miles to a strange land with strange people and strange customs. He never been away from home. Probably never been outside of the city limits of Jerusalem, except maybe to visit some aunts and uncles out there somewhere. In Bethany or somewhere, maybe, possibly. But now he's been taken hundreds of miles, a captive, and meeting all kind of strange people that talk strangely and worship strange gods and wear strange clothes. And here he is right in the middle of all this situation. Oh, look at the pressure to conform. And then, as we've already pointed out, they're young, only teenagers. And Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful ruler in the earth at that time and any time. There never has been a more powerful ruler, more power concentrated in an individual than in Nebuchadnezzar. Now, there have been larger kingdoms and larger places controlled by one man, but not with the concentrated power that Nebuchadnezzar had. He was the head of gold, and he was the mightiest of the mighty, the strongest of the strong, the greatest king that ever lived, Nebuchadnezzar. And here these little boys from Jerusalem have got to stand up against him and say, we're not going to eat your food. Oh, we're not going to eat what you bring us. We just aren't going to do that because it's not right to do that. Now, they're to be taught now by the world's greatest scholars. You see, when a king becomes great, one thing he starts gathering to himself are teachers, scholars in different fields, huge libraries. You ever notice that a president leaves office, he always wants to build a library, you know, to put all his books in and all his archives and all these things, you see. Well, it's a king like Nebuchadnezzar would build huge universities and schools and bring in the best of professors and the best of knowledge and training and science and all these things because he's the number one king in the number one kingdom. And they're going to be taught by these scholars that have all this knowledge and training. Their subjects are going to be the pagan subjects. They're going to have astrology now as one of their subjects. They're going to be studying mythology and about all the gods of Babylon and who they are and how strong they are and mighty they are and things of that nature. So it's going to be a completely different world for them. The prospect of attaining high government posts were held out to them. Now, if you do this, boys, if you eat this food, and if you cooperate, you're going up. No place to go but up. We brought you from Jerusalem for one purpose, and that's to promote you and to make you high government officers in the greatest nation on earth, the most powerful nation on earth. And you're going to get to be a part of it. Just think of the influence you can be if you'll bend. Just think of the testimony you'll be if you'll give. Just think of what you can do and how much good you can do. Isn't it amazing? You know, always the call of the devil to compromise is always how much good you can do and how much of a blessing you can be if you'll cut some corners and compromise. Well, that prospect was held before them. They would be able to eat the finest of food from the king's table. Boy, that'd be something good, I'll tell you. Wouldn't be nothing trashy about that. And, of course, the best of the wine. Now, and they have been given new names, as we saw, so they could just blend in with the Babylonian community and fold their tents and just kind of quietly slip away and say, well, we didn't have anything to do with being brought here, fellas. We'd rather be back home there with our people and stuff. And we're here, so let's just do like they do. Let's just act like they act. Let's just fold in and mix in with the society. Eat the food and forget about all those other things that we've learned. Now, that's the temptation that was before these young men. And don't you think it wasn't real? It was very strong and very real. Now, would they be able to stand the test? The food was the test. You see? The question is, would they be able to stand the test? And so we read in verse 8, but Daniel purposed. That's a strong word. He said, you're not going to move me off of this position. This is the purpose. Now, he didn't set a goal. Bless God. These people who set goals, these goal-oriented people. Don't get swallowed up in that. That's part of psychology, of course, modern psychology. Goal-oriented. I got a goal that by the time I am such and such an age, I'm going to have so much money put aside. And I'm going to be prepared for this. And I've got a goal that by the time I've reached this age, that I'm going to have a degree in this and a degree in that. All this stuff. Or I've got a goal that this, and I've got a goal about. Forget the goals. The Bible's not goal oriented. The Bible is purpose oriented. The Bible is purpose oriented. What's your purpose? Only one purpose: glorify God. Only one purpose: to glorify God. Forget your goals. And say, I'm going to glorify God. My life's going to be lived for Him, and I'm going to bring honor to His name. I'm going to glorify Him, and I'm going to be what He wants me to be. I don't care what anybody else does. That's purpose-oriented. And so Daniel was purpose-oriented. He wasn't goal-oriented. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. See, he knew that would defile him to do that. And he said, I can't defile myself. If I'm defiled, I can't fellowship with God. If I'm defiled, I can't fellowship with you fellas if you stay undefiled. I'm not going to defile myself. I'm going to stay where I can fellowship with God. I'm going to stay in right relationship to God over here in this land of Babylon. If I don't get along with anybody else, I want to get along with God. I want Him to be my friend, and I want to be his friend, and I want to get along with God no matter what else happens. And so he purposed that he wasn't going to eat this. Now, he requested, he purposed in his heart, but notice now, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, he didn't go out and stick his fist on his chest and holler like Tarzan or something like that and say, "All right, fellas, I challenge you. I'm not going to eat your food. I'm not going to do that." He didn't do it that way. That wasn't the way he handled it. He went through the proper channels. There was a way to do a thing. You see, you don't have to make a fool of yourself doing right. There's a way to do a thing. And so he went to the prince of the eunuchs, and he requested that he might not defile himself. Now, God, verse 9, God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. You see, Daniel was the kind of person that had, just like we talked about last message, remember we talked about these boys and how they were trained? And Daniel had already made such a friend of this prince of the eunuchs. Say, they'd been together for some weeks or months now. They'd had to travel all the way from Jerusalem to Babylon. That took some weeks. In the cases where we find Ezra and Nehemiah and those others going from Babylon back the other way, it always took, I believe it was 3 months at least for them to make that journey. So they had been 3 months at least with this fella. That's a long time, 90 days to get to know somebody. And this prince of the eunuchs found out that these were just gentlemen. These young men were just fine young men. And they were gentlemen, and they got to know each other, and they conversed, and they talked, and together. And so the prince of the eunuchs just fell in love with these fellows. He said, they are great, great fellows. And Daniel, in particular, found favor with him. And the prince of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort?" And then there were others, see, that were being tested during the same time. "Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king." It's as if I have to come up and present you a bunch of skinny fellers, look like starved rats, and the king's going to look at me and say, "What in the world have you done to these fellas?" And it's going to be my head. I'll tell you what it'll be. And so Daniel said, okay. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink." Now, pulse means vegetables. Now, I almost hate to tell you that. These boys were health nuts. No. It wasn't that they had anything against meat, as long as it was the right kind of meat, and not offered to idols, that would have been all right. But one thing about vegetables was that they didn't have to worry about it being something on the list that they couldn't eat, and also that it wasn't offered to idols. And so they said, "Just give us, approve us for 10 days, that's all. Give us vegetables to eat and water to drink, and let's see what happens. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants." Now, he didn't say he was going, "If it failed, I'll go back and eat the king's." He didn't say that. He'd already purposed he wasn't going to do it. But he gave God an open door of opportunity. In other words, this is a step of faith on Daniel's part. He said, "Let us for 10 days eat this, and then you look at us and see. Let our God take care of us. Let him put the sustenance and those vegetables and in that water that we need, and let him do it. We'll step out on faith in this matter." So he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Now, don't go off and start preaching and teaching that we all ought to be vegetarians and that we'd be fatter in, some of us don't need to be fatter in flesh. That if vegetables make you fatter than what I've been eating, I don't need it. But they look good. I mean, their cheeks were plump, and their flesh looked good. And so Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine which they should drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four children, God gave them, now notice, they gave them vegetables, but look what God gave them. Oh, listen, you stand for God and he'll take care of you. He already has made that diet that they were eating make them fair and fat and flesh. But now notice, and as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now, all four of them had knowledge and wisdom. See, knowledge is good, but wisdom is knowing how to use knowledge and how to use it properly. So they had knowledge and wisdom, and then Daniel had understanding. Oh, he had a depth of understanding. 17-year-old boy. 17-year-old boy serving God and standing in this fashion. Now notice verse 18. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. He brought in all these captives. I don't know how many there were. Maybe there were 20, 30, 40, maybe 100. I don't know how many there were. We have no way of knowing that. But whenever the king got through questioning them and quizzing them and talking with them, and he said, boy, these four, there's nothing like them. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. In other words, they were given immediately high positions in the kingdom. Can you imagine teenagers in a foreign land being put in such a position as that? You see how faithful they were to God and how faithful God was to them. Now get this, verse 20. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. Already, they're 10 times better than the best he had. And Daniel continued even until the first year of King Cyrus, which was 5 kingdoms later. Well, we completed chapter 1. And when we get into chapter 2, we're going to get into the first dream, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and how the whole bunch of magicians and soothsayers were about ready to have their heads cut off. Well, I tell you, that King Nebuchadnezzar didn't mess around. You know, whenever you crossed him, you were in trouble. And Daniel, of course, by the grace of God, after much prayer, steps in and interprets the dream. Father, we thank you for your word. How precious, how wonderful. Give us young people like Daniel. Give us young people who say, I'm going to stand for God. I don't care what other people. I'm not going to look around and see what my friends are doing. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to do right no matter what happens. If the stars fall, I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to stand for thee in these days that we live in. Lord, help us all to say that. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen.